This is the Erasing Shame Podcast, Season 5, Diverse Perspectives Discussing What Matters. Welcome to a new episode of the Erasing Shame Podcast. My name is DJ Chuang, one of the co-hosts, and all four co-hosts are here with us around the table: Hannah Lee Sandoval, Leah Abraham, and George Chong. We've had so many activities in our Asian American communities over the past month and a half, and we only have about an hour to process that. And I'm pretty sure if you've watched the news and blogs and social media, there's been a lot of different conversations as well as confusion about the shootings and the hate crimes and the violence and the atrocities and all kinds of things. And to get us started, we want to take a few minutes to check in with each other and make sure that we're okay and we might have a coherent conversation in this safe place. And we hope that by our conversation that you will feel a sense of belonging and not isolation that all this news can cause for us. So let me start with Hannah, and then we'll just go around. I'm doing okay, as okay can be. I got my first vaccine shot 2 weeks ago.
Yay!
And I've been keeping up with the news, and there's been a lot of chatter on Clubhouse, which is an iPhone invite-only app where there's a lot of chatter. But a lot of grief, a lot of anger and frustration is what I'm hearing as well as feeling. But that's just briefly. I'll come back around after everybody else has had a chance to check in and share. So Hannah, how are you doing? Really?
I'm, as Leah taught us, COVID okay. Actually, I've been using that more and more and teaching my clients about that phrase because it's so gracious. It lowers the bar for, you know, being okay, and it normalizes that we're all kind of like, meh. I thought I was much more okay than I am. But I'm in brain spotting therapy, which is like, you know, processing on like a deeper emotional level. And I had this like picture when I was processing of a bunch of Asian women like huddled in a dark cellar, like, you know, like a sweatshop kind of feeling, where we were so just embattled in the darkness and like holding tightly to each other, you know, just to survive. And it was like this heavy, dragging, depressed, captive kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't realized I was carrying that, you know, and I've been processing almost nonstop since the Atlanta shootings, but even before, with some of my clients, a lot of the racially motivated hate crimes, and how as Asian American women, we just don't feel safe often. And then after the Atlanta shootings, it was almost like trauma upon trauma. Like people were already struggling, like kicking somebody when you're down, you know, already. And so there was just a lot of grief, but I also saw like numbness and shutting down, which I think I experienced myself to cope. So I guess now when people ask like, oh, are you doing okay with things? I'm like, I don't know. I think every day it changes. It depends on who I've spoken to, how I'm feeling that day, what's happening in the news. But I've been really trying to pay attention to boundaries and self-care, because I know that if I don't do that, I'm going to fall off into some kind of deep depression and not be functional, because it's just so heavy, right? So that's how I am.
Thank you for sharing. Leah?
Yeah, I don't think I'm doing well right now. And I guess I'm phrasing it that way mostly because I think a part of my brain right now, it's just like resisting going to that space of being open and fully feeling what I'm probably experiencing right now. So I can sort of feel that tension in my brain as we're delving into this conversation, and it being like, no, we're safe. We can like operate normally in this plane if we keep it shut. But I just the past few weeks, like my anxiety and my depression is, they're both pretty bad right now.
Sorry.
And it's also just really interesting because in my personal journey and my journey of decolonization and all of that, like I'm doing a lot of work in trying to just some deep work in terms of finding and learning more about my roots and my relationship to my ancestral lands and all of just sort of those kind of stuff, while also processing the fact that, oh, like there's so much, just the, all the racial tension of this country, and then realizing and constantly having to remember, I'm a brown body in this country, and the political, the social significance and impact of that, and constantly having to battle between shutting down and just going into survival mode versus like, I need to stay vigilant and I need to pursue justice. And so like just this, all of it sort of muddled together. It feels like a lot these days, to be honest. I am juggling a lot of those right now.
Well, thanks for making some time to check in. And we won't push the topic too hard, but we do.
No. I want to for this.
Say that it is a safe place to at least engage the topic. George, how are you?
We might just have to scrap our plans for today and just do a little group therapy and support each other in this. Man, it's been a long month and a half. It's kind of felt like at least twice, if not three times as long since the last time that we've been able to check in, and so much has happened. And, you know, as I'm thinking through my experience, there's a part of me that feels as though I have it easy still. And just recognizing, even just the privileges that come with being a man in this society, and a lot of the processing that I had to do with my wife after the Atlanta shootings, and trying to just process with her in that space what she's experiencing, all the while worrying for the Hmong community and just knowing how hard we've been struck with COVID. And then in addition to that, the fear of the elderly in our communities being attacked. And I've been reading a bit more on how to provide better care for our BIPOC communities. And just coming to the realization again and again that it's not just the regular mental health issues that I have to help them process through, but it's all the emotional baggage on top of that, of just their day-to-day experiences. And so processing even with my Asian American clients, a lot of their stories, a lot of their experiences as they go through their day-to-day, some not knowing what to do with the frustration, others not knowing what to do with the fear and the sadness, and all the while I'm trying to process through my own emotions and process and you know, make sure I'm taking care of my own mental health, and a lot of it just gets messy. I've really appreciated just being able to hear Leah, both you and Hannah's experiences, and I think we all kind of recognize that it really just takes your own pace to go through what you need to go through. And we can't really put any expectations on how quickly we have to process through something. But there are hopefully spaces that we each can go to process. And if we know of those spaces, then it makes it a lot easier for us to care well for ourselves, as opposed to simply just running away from the discomfort. But yeah, so I feel like a lot of my processing gets put on the back burner because I'm working with other people who are processing a lot of the time. But I've also experienced a lot of good healing through processing with other people. So
thank you, George. Well, we have a moment here in our initial conversation to choose a direction. We can stay on the personal and caring for our community. I was on a online conference this weekend as we're recording this, talking about lived theology in Asian Americans, among Asian Americans, and they were talking about, you know, how can we move from self-care to our care, so that's not just a solitary effort, but that we could care for one another. So that's on the personal level, or we could go in the more societal and political realm and talk about the issue, which is just as an emotional kind of work, but more ideological. So what are you ready to go with in the next hour?
You know, I'm going to be on a panel next week at DJ's invitation. And one of the questions kind of was like, well, what are you doing, you know, amidst all this? Like, the question is always, what do we do about it, right? How do we change things and improve things? And I had trouble with that question because so many of my clients are these, like, relatively woke, you know, or very, very woke. Some of them are like straight up activists, women. And a lot of times I hear this shame and guilt about not doing enough because they are aware of all the big isms and the intersectionality and the, what I call macro level dynamics. So what I'm going to address and share in the panel next week is I think as a social worker, I'm able to kind of distinguish there's the personal micro level, right? Which is my mental health and self-care and how I personally engage and, you know, how I'm processing things. And then there's meso level, which is like churches, nonprofits, institutions, schools. And then macros, like when we look at maybe the whole country or the whole county, like the large pieces and the isms and the abstracts. And my thing is, I think we need to do all, and we need to find a way to integrate, because we've maybe said, okay, well, some people will be activists and others will not be, when it's really like, well, no, we can all engage in activism by being a certain way and relating to each other a certain way. So I would love if we could take the time to talk about the isms and define some of these terms. I've found that helpful because the way people define things also affects how they feel about themselves. A lot of the time, a lot of guilt, shame, and inadequacy about not being this enough or being too that, right? And I'm not in a position to define those terms. I'm still learning.
Yeah, there's a lot of vocabulary that comes with dealing with the isms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some are more well-read, engaged, and some or in process as you are and I am. So maybe Leah, can you help us with some definition in terms of what being woke is and some no other vocabulary sure. words?
Yeah, I'll do my best. And I will be honest, I don't know exactly when I don't know who to attribute wokeness to, but I do know that it started coming to the more pop culture vernacular, like I think around the time of Michael Brown's death, the Ferguson, Missouri shooting. And it is, I think, first predominantly used within the Black community to signal whether someone was aware, or probably more like, are you sleeping to the fact or sleeping to the reality of the injustices that are happening? Or are you woke? Are you aware and awakened and your eyes are directly staring at it? And it's sort of, I think more, I would probably label that as more progressive term, or like progressive circles use it as a litmus test on, are you aware of this? Or are you on the other spectrum or on the other side of not being aware of it and it not being in it. And I think a lot of people probably also use it as a safety. Like, are you woke as in, are you safe for me, especially for underrepresented and oppressed groups? And I think Hannah, you sort of alluded to it, but like, there's also a culture of like, there is an almost like this pressure to be woke enough, to be in the conversations, to know enough to, So I'm just curious, maybe to start, when we're talking about the word woke and wokeness, what are your personal experiences and journey with that word?
The word's so new. George, go for it.
Yeah, no, as some of my friends and I were talking about when these things came up, and even like the term social justice, I think social justice has always kind of been around, probably back in the 80s. And there were a lot of movements early on that kind of started working towards social justice. But I think pop culture wise, it really started getting picked up around that 2014-ish time around Michael Brown and the start of even, you know, Black Lives Matters and things like that. And in these spaces, I think for me, it's been interesting to just hear the responses in the communities that I've been to wokeness, which for the past 4 or 5 years has been in a very white evangelical seminary setting, where it's in those white centric circles, very frowned upon. And I think in today's response to it is just the fear of allowing, you know, critical race theory to have any footing or any place in the church, or any place in the ways that we consider how we address justice within the world as we're living in it. And so I think I've done a lot of work to help other people come to a space of awakening. My undergrad years, so back in 2011, I founded our racial reconciliation organization on campus at Northwestern in St. Paul. And I did it in order to kind of help a lot of these white dominant cultured kids really interact with a more global and diverse understanding of their experience. My friend and I, when we started in 2009, the school was at a 4% diversity percentage with our student body. We worked as ambassadors for a year and a half, and we brought that up to 14%. So all of a sudden, there were many, many more students of color on campus. And it really began to shift then the experience that was there, and really just needed that ability to say, okay, look, we don't need you to like know everything, but we need you to be at least aware that the ways that you do things, the way that you are experiencing things as a white person in society isn't the only experience that exists out there. And so a lot of my work in reconciliation and racial reconciliation has simply been coming into places of understanding with other people and helping them understand our experiences more clearly. And so that's kind of my understanding of wokeness is, are you willing to put yourself in a position to learn and to simply become aware of another person's experience?
DJ, so
yeah, I would add to that I would add to the awareness thing, because there are those who are aware of what's happening in the pop cultural and ideological conversation and are very judgmental and shaming about those who are active in voicing their concerns for justice of the marginalized and those who are BIPOC and disadvantaged and explaining the hate crime. It's a very exhausting kind of thing for those who are woke versus those who are attacking it and being judgmental mm-hmm. with it. And so I think wokeness implies empathy for, at least mm-hmm. empathy, whether you Absolutely. Engage in activism or not, but at yeah. least empathy for your fellow human person being that is living in this reality and in this experience, rather than the technicalities of the law or the way things should be or ought to be. And mm-hmm. So I have relationships and friends on both sides of that woke or not wokeness. Mm-hmm. And it's, well, it seems obvious to me, they're not talking to each other as people. They're still mm-hmm. talking or reading and talking at the ideological level. Mm-hmm. And in one sense, kind of playing a game of chess with people's feelings and existence. Mm-hmm. And that's not very kind. Mm-hmm. And so experientially, as I enter into this, rather than just listening to the chatter or mm-hmm. seeing the chatter on social media, there's been a couple moments in the past month where I realize I'm walking in my neighborhood. I'm near a town center here in suburbia, Aliso Viejo, California. And I realized I'm walking alone as an Asian American person. And I felt the thought of fear crossed my mind. I was like, I shouldn't be walking around. I should be driving places because these are uncertain times. And these hate crimes just happen out of the blue and in random situations. Mm-hmm. And I don't need to be putting myself at risk at that, even here in suburbia. And we do have incidents, even here in Orange County, where there are Asian American hate crimes. So, mm-hmm. so being in the suburbs is not immunity from being attacked. And that's the sad state of being. This past week, we took a road trip, family road trip to Oakland. So we're in downtown Chinatown, Oakland, where the attack happened somewhere. I'm not sure if we were at the block or not, but we saw a group of 20 people dressed in yellow and blue, and they were part of the Compassion and Action crowd, not policing, but just walking around, making their presence known and providing that sense of safety for people. So it's
like a neighborhood.
Yes. And they've done a great work at providing some safety for the elderly that are vulnerable, trying to walk around the neighborhood. So this is a very real situation, and there are lives at stake. So it's not just an ideology. We've got to come to an understanding of those human experiences.
Yeah. I feel like I've approached this idea of wokeness as like a lens. You know, when you put on glasses, you can see more clearly. That not everybody is comfortable, you know, putting on or wearing. And it's been a journey for me. I love, Leah, how you talk about decolonization. That's been, you know, part of a newer, you know, part of my process the past year or so. And I think the ideas of decolonization and becoming more woke and anti-racism have kind of really come together for me. And I'm a learner right now. And I've talked with clients about how there are like stages of activism too, and how we also want to be sustainable, right? I remember when the news about George Floyd and you know, just people responding and the protests and all that was happening. I think I was on the news like 4 hours a day, including social media, you know, and at one point I like couldn't focus on anything else, and that wasn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. Like even my toddler was like, no phone. 'Cause he saw I was so like worked up and in a crisis state for weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk to my clients now, I'm like, it's that feeling again of like, oh my God, I need to plug in. I need to look, I need to put on the lens. I need to keep it on. I need to pay attention. But it's also so triggering and jarring that we sort of can look at it with more grace sometimes. And if people feel like, oh, I'm not doing enough, I'm not reading enough, I'm not knowledgeable enough, to just say, well, try and recognize maybe where in your journey you are and what do you need right now personally so that your journey, you can remain sustained on your journey. Because if you just are suddenly like pressuring yourself to go out and go to every protest and every campaign and every, just jump on every bandwagon before you've really done a lot of personal work, you're going to burn out after a while. And I, when I was learning from activists back in college, what I saw was there was a lot of burned out, tired people with a lot of grief. And, you know, granted we were like all in our 20s or something, but I did remember thinking, how do you do this for life, right? How do you do this for life? I came across actually Grace Lee Boggs. I don't know a lot about her, but I was just kind of talking to the client and doing a Google search. But she writes books about like sustainable activism and doing it as a lifestyle. And so my attention's been turned towards, okay, well, yeah, it's fine that I don't feel woke enough. It's fine that I don't feel like I'm doing enough in terms of activism, but I am doing what I can. I'm trying to accept that I'm in a stage of growth, you know, and I want to keep moving forward, but I do want to keep doing this the rest of my life, whatever it may look like at any stage, right? Yeah. So I've been trying to put a lot of grace into this journey of becoming more aware. And for me, the battle has been actually like, okay, maybe less information and news and more processing, because I'm really fighting on a daily basis not to dissociate, to cope. So that's where the activism is for me, is to like, don't detach, you know, like self, try and stay plugged in as much as you can for the day and do what you need to so you can remain attuned and empathetic and caring, because that's the most important part, is what's happening in my heart, not how many facts and figures I know.
I actually struggle with the word woke a lot, and I have since I heard it back when I was in college. I think was the first time I went to a small private university where it was very white. The diversity numbers are terrible. But I was like one of two undergraduate Indian students at that time. And so being, and oftentimes like I just took on the responsibility of like, oh, I am the token brown friend for so many people. And so I have to be, like, I just took on the responsibility of being the educator, like being patient with microaggressions. And and so I think when woke started becoming a thing, I was just so guilty and had so much shame around what I didn't know. But then also it was this idea of you still took on this responsibility. And so I think like identifiers like that, I really struggle with because of the pressure of being wrong. But personally, I think I struggled with pressure of like disappointing people, which is one of my core wounds. And so I really struggle with woke. And I think when I was given, when I found freedom in that concept, was when I heard Christina Cleveland. She is a Black woman theologian who's just fantastic and does a lot of work around sacred feminine right now. But she, in one of her talks, she said that she doesn't use woke, she uses waking. So she moves from an identifier to an action. She's like, no one's ever woke. We're never arrived at a point where we see all of it. And it's often a journey. I think for me, reframing it that way was so freeing. It allowed me to just really own my journey and just, right? Like, I think kind of like where that growth, just embracing the learner and the grower and just like, this is where we are. So that for me, and so I've been trying to figure out ways to reframe a lot of these words when we're talking about racial justice a lot. I recently learned from the organizational gender space that's based in Canada, that instead of saying you are an ally, what if you use practicing allyship? Right? So when we're talking about someone being an ally, it's someone from a predominantly privileged group trying to stand alongside with someone who's oppressed. So whether that's through racism or whether it's like LGBTQ issues, right? When you're saying you're an ally, that's a tall order. But if you're saying I'm practicing allyship, that is your journey. And so for me, moving from identifiers to more action-oriented words have really been helpful to just finding that grace and just really getting, just dealing with that shame that comes with this.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was great. You know, something I've been talking about when you're talking about explaining yourself and being patient with microaggressions, totally identified. I did that in seminary. Something I've learned and realized more lately is that, like, Asian Americans need to learn to be allies to themselves, right? Or learn to practice allyship to ourselves. Because we've so often, and this is a phrase I use a lot in therapy, is like emotional labor. We so often take on the role of teaching, also reassuring people who have just like offended us, right? And we're like, it's okay, they're apologizing, like a white person's apologizing, because we're like, it's okay, I'm not that hurt, I'm fine. This has been happening my whole life, we're good, you know? When it's okay for us to be like, thank you for your apology. That means a lot. Please don't do it again. You know, is that we're so not used to even practicing allyship internally with ourselves to be like, that actually offended me, that wounded me, that I felt disrespected, that wasn't okay. Cause we're so it's normalized in our cultures just to be like, well, just put your head down, be quiet, and just, you know, don't make a big deal out of it. Don't be too sensitive. I was having some conversations with some elders, you know, mostly API, and their immigration trauma was on full display in terms of, I was talking about some of these things and why younger people seem to really care, you know, and why we're constantly posting on Facebook because they're like, why are you so obsessed about this thing? And I was explaining, like, you know, because we're coming to this state of consciousness together. And then also Asian Americans, like, we're not a monolithic group. We've been, you know, titled as such, but we're not. And now we're trying to actually come together to form some kind of social political power, build safety, find our voice and all that. And elders have been like, but this is nothing new. Why are you suddenly doing things now? You know, like, what about back in my country when this and this was happening? That ended badly. That's why we came here. This is not going to end well for you. Like, okay, you know, if it makes you feel good about it, fine. But injustice, evil, violence, you know, racism, this happens, and oppression, it's constantly happening all around the world. It always has been. And then their fatalistic attitude that's very trauma driven, it always will. Nothing will really change. But go ahead and try. My generation did. I saw them fail. You're welcome to do the same. You know, and that's like a hurtful conversation a lot of times, but just being able to say, but yeah, I understand that you feel that way, mom, dad, you know, auntie, uncle, but it's still important to me. And I still have hope for my generation. And we do believe that the world is changing, you know, things are different today than they were in your generation, right? So yeah, it's been a lot to process. But I think this idea of like learning to be gracious and patient with ourselves and our own communities, but also creating the space to say, like, I do have really strong feelings about this, and that's okay. I don't have to feel bad or shameful that I was offended or upset at this person for being ignorant or hurtful.
Wow, there's so much to chew on. so many different experiences, and I think, Leah, you hit it right on the head that there's no need to kind of judge where we are, right? Mm-hmm. But that we can simply just allow ourselves to continue to grow in our awareness and our experiences and what we're capable of doing, and you know, I think, especially in wokeness, but also in allyship, like, these are growing processes that are going to have growing pains, right? And we have to be honest with ourselves in those spaces, that when we come to a realization of, you know, spaces in which we've allowed our colonizing to, you know, hamper us or hamper the communities that we're a part of, like that hurts, right? And that's frustrating to come to a realization of. But it also then provides us a new way forward, right? And it provides us hope that, oh, things can change, right? And we can change our mentalities around these things. And so very similarly in these spaces of trying to help others understand our experiences and understand their own experience as well, that there are going to be moments where the truths that are realized, the truths that are revealed to us, oftentimes are going to hurt before we can find healing. And those processes are natural to go through and okay to go through. We can't skip through a lot of these things and hopefully just arrive at a sense of wokeness or simply arrive at a place of full allyship. And so I'm just really appreciative in being able to listen into a lot of your processing. And, you know, DJ, I think as you were kind of sharing about, it's going beyond awareness, right? And it really requires empathy to get into this place of not just simply knowing that things are happening, being aware that racism exists, but it really requires empathy to then be moved to make change, right? And I was having a conversation with a friend the other night, and they were like, what is justice? What is like social justice? How do you move towards change? And I think the realization that I came to was really just that it, justice is empathy in action. Right.
Mm. Nice.
Justice. That's a keeper.
That'll tweet.
Yeah. Right. Because you really have to allow yourself to empathize with someone, understand their experience and be in that space with them for it to move you to want to see change in their experience. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. move you to want to help bring healing and bring change into that. And so you know, I think, you know, a lot of what we're saying is just really encouraging to hear that we can go through our personal experiences, we can go through and try to help other people experience that as well. Mm-hmm. And what's going to move us all towards change, whether it's individual or as a community, it's going to require empathy on all fronts. Mm-hmm. To really say, okay, well, we don't want to sit here in this space together, you know, any longer. Right. And so this is what's pushing us out to go and find change, go and create that change for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate the stories you've shared. I appreciate, Leah, how you found a way to reframe these words with waking, practicing allyship, and it parallels to what we're realizing in the world, that we don't want to be stuck in binaries. Mm-hmm. So woke or not woke, or mm-hmm. ally or not ally, but there's mm-hmm. a whole process that people come along, and we're all part of the human race. We're all part of the humanity, mm-hmm. and we have different experiences, sure, but when you know, how many experiences do you need to hear or know of before you realize that's part of reality rather than mm-hmm. ignoring it? Mm-hmm. And so when we have conversations with fellow Asians or Asian Americans, they deny the reality of the or the perspective of the isms. You know, how many hate crimes does a person have to endure, or their family or friends endure, before they realize, yeah, there's something more wrong than just that individual who did something hateful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That there's systemic and social issues that are at stake. And then, there's I think I've studied Asian cultures and American cultures enough to say that Asian cultures tend to start from a fatalistic perspective. Mm-hmm. That because of history, our actions aren't going to be enough to change the historical mm-hmm. patterns of things. Yeah. America's still a very young nation, mm-hmm. and America's right. more of a open sandbox where we have the potential to change mm-hmm. at least our society, and in less than 250 years we have seen changes, and so it's more it's not the fatalistic. I'm not sure what the other antonym would be for that. Mm-hmm. So there is a role that we can play, but it can only come from a healthy place when we mm-hmm. do take care of ourselves and with each other. And so I want to explore a bit a word that's been repeated by every one of us, the word processing. Mm-hmm. So I know there's probably a technical definition for that from the counselors here at the table. But what is processing, so that for our viewers and listeners that are, you know, they have all these feelings, but when we say processing, what does that actually look like? What does it feel like? How can we guide someone into what this thing that sounds pretty good, and it's a thing that we can do, whether individually, personally, to be processing so that we go from where we are to a healthier place. Is that what processing is? And what is it?
I feel like George would have a better, you're very articulate, a better way of saying it, but I'll just quickly. So I practice a lot of brain spotting, which is a form of a trauma treatment. And I also receive brain spotting, but it's basically what we call subcortical or brain-based processing, where you're not just thinking your thoughts about it and like talking without really paying attention to also the emotional kind of dynamics. So, you know, we generally think of like thoughts as separate from feelings, as separate from our body, mm-hmm. but they're all integrated because we're whole beings, right? Unfortunately, we very much live and relate to ourselves as kind of disjointed beings or compartmentalized. And so mm-hmm. with brain spotting, you know, I'll often ask my clients or even the people I practice with or when I'm receiving it, what emotion am I feeling, you know, related to the thoughts I'm thinking and the experiences I'm kind of ruminating on? And then where in my body am I holding some of that energy, emotional energy? And so to do mind, body, and, you know, kind of holistic processing altogether, so that I'm being an entire person and I'm taking into account how my body, my brain, my heart, how everything's experiencing something, and to give time and space to that, just to like listen to myself. And the interesting thing that I learned during training for that was our brain and body communication. Not that the brain is not part of the body, but in terms of like the lower half, there's more communication coming into the brain from this part rather than from here down. Mm-hmm. And that was like, huh? My brain's communicating to itself? Like that is, there's so much internal communication happening, mm-hmm. but we're often not listening because it's not really in this neocortical conscious part of our brain. But when we're able to kind of like drop down and people say like, oh, it feels like Zen or like hypnosis or meditation, it's like, yeah, we're using mindfulness, but we're really focusing it on what are you feeling in your body? What are you feeling emotionally? And what's coming up for you intellectually? And let's bring it together so that your brain can almost like organize everything it's going through and make sense of it, right? We call it reprocessing, so that you feel a little bit more like integrated and coherent internally, right? So this idea of like, oh, my heart and my mind are fighting, or this internal battle, well, it's like, well, if we bring the warring factions together and they realize they're on the same team, you know, we'll probably get a lot more coherence and clarity. So that's what I consider processing, is sitting with your feelings, connecting them to your thoughts and your historical experiences, being really compassionate, mindful, empathetic with yourself, maybe with the support of another person or people, allows for what we call regulation, or kind of balancing things out, right? Making sense and sort of organizing internally. George, you probably have a much more clear definition.
I mean... That was great. You know, I think that really reveals to us, you know, the neuroscientific, you know, processes that our body has to go through, our minds have to go through, to really get us to a place of actually understanding what we've just experienced, right? Or what we've experienced in the past that we've chosen to not allow the process to complete itself. And, you know, I think for me, like, illustration wise, my mind goes to like watching videos, and then every once in a while you get the buffering circle, right? And your computer has to process the information before it's able to give you, you know, what you want to see, right? And there are times in which we get really annoyed with the process of having to wait to really get to experience what we want to experience. And it's in those spaces of discomfort and just feeling like I don't want to wait to get to the end point, where we then find times to distract ourselves, or, you know, try to refresh, or we try to, you know, go into other areas of, you know, getting to the end of it. So I think that for me is a lot of the work that I have to do with my clients, is recognizing that in your discomfort, oftentimes you want to skip the process, or you want to run away from the process. And that's okay. I think everybody, you know, I think as humans, we're just bent towards running away from pain and finding something that will bring us comfort or pleasure. And in that space, we oftentimes distract ourselves long enough to either forget about what's been bothering us, or it pushes us to the place of, okay, well, no, I can't ignore it anymore, and I actually have to deal with it. But if we allow ourselves to take the time that's needed to really just enjoy every experience for what it is, that's the healthy process in which we don't have to end up getting caught up on things or tripping over things that we've swept under the rug. We can take things on as they come and know that we're going to be okay in the process of it. But learning to be okay with the process is really the hardest part. And so similarly to what Hannah was explaining in her work, I work out of DBT a lot of the time. So dialectical behavioral therapy. And we just, you know, want to help you understand, really being able to ask the questions: what am I feeling? What made me feel this way? Do I have to feel this way? If I don't, what else can I be feeling? And how do I... how do I share this with other people? And a part of the process is really doing it in community. And I think communication is really key for any process. A lot of people who are in those spaces where like they're like, no, I don't need to talk to anyone about this. Right? The reasons why they don't is because there's been hurt in the past that they haven't processed through. That makes it feel unsafe to be that vulnerable with someone, right? But if we get past that space, we can really help ourselves to recognize like, oh, the only way to really process this is to have someone actually understand and empathize with what I'm experiencing, letting me know that it's okay for me to feel this way, and then allowing me to move from this space as opposed to feeling anchored and stuck here, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know if that was more articulate than Hannah's, but.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. Because it's a new concept for so many of us, myself included, I wanted to unpack that from several perspectives. So it does take that repetition and multiple examples, because I know from my own life, it took me well into my 40s before I could process my feelings.
Wow.
Because we come from an Asian culture that doesn't even talk about feeling. And that's the whole premise of this podcast, Erasing Shame. It's just so much that we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. Now, the point isn't that we got to talk about our feelings with the whole world. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you do need to talk about you do need to express your feelings in a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's art therapy and there's other kinds of therapy that don't require words.
Yeah.
But what processing is at its essence is getting those feelings outside of your body, because your body does keep score. So when unprocessed feelings simmer and stay stuck in your body, it will come out sideways, is what they metaphorically say. So in Asian culture, when we say we eat our bitterness or we drink our bitterness, and the Korean concept of, is it Han, I think it is, where we can suffer like there's no end. Well, there is an end if we don't process that suffering and those painful feelings.
Yeah.
What does it look like in South Asian, or at least what does it look like from your vantage point, Leah?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, guess I shouldn't have you speak for everybody. I just realized that.
Please speak for all brown people.
No, I think that's definitely the ever suffering, the ever enduring, especially, yeah. So that completely exists there. I'm actually curious. Well, I want to take a moment to confess where I still struggle, because I think I still, as you guys were talking about what processing is and realizing that, like, oh, there's still a lot of shame I hold about wokeness, even though awesome definitions about it and such. I realize that when I walk into rooms where I know, especially we're talking about justice issues, I do a scan of the room, and I think I subconsciously rate everyone's wokeness to realize I stand in comparison to them, so I can choose how I interact with them. And I've also recently started to do this thing where I pre-plan apologies in the chances that I screw up. And my tendency is to freeze in moments like that. So I'm like, I need to practice this apology so I don't get stuck and look like an idiot. So for anyone listening still struggling with wokeness and just being enough, awoke enough, and just scared doing the wrong thing, you're not alone.
Thank you.
I'm still just extremely scared to get it wrong.
Same.
I think too, Leah, just to kind of share my experience as a mental health professional in this space, right? I think one of the core values of mental health that you're taught is multicultural competency. And unfortunately, oftentimes competency comes out as, I know about your people, right? I know how to deal with your people's issues. Which is a very horrible way to learn and to practice multicultural competency. And the reality is, it's much more closely related to this idea of, I know that I don't know your experience. Right. And because I don't know, I want to give you the space to simply be and express, right. That competency in multiculturalism and in race issues, whatever, it's not about what you know about the other person. It's about what you still need to learn, right? And it's in that space in which, again, there's so much more grace to interact with different peoples. It's much more easy to give yourself the opportunities to mess up when you need to in order to learn. But you have to own those things as well, right? But I'm just really thankful, Leah, for your reflections. And yeah, everybody who's listening, like, again, like, wokeness isn't something that you arrive at. It's something that you just continue to experience and grow in. And it's that cringy moment in which, and I've had this happen a couple of times with some white counterparts, but it's in that cringy moment when they say, I get it, I'm woke, that you're like, ah, You were so close.
Until you said that.
You were so close. But I think we all can just, you know, live in that space of just recognizing, like, even colored people aren't woke. Like, and it's not safe to assume that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we can just accept that everybody's in their process, everybody's in their own spaces.
Yeah.
Okay, so to use another vocabulary word, don't weaponize wokeness.
Well, same thing when we say, like, don't weaponize cancel culture. Mm-hmm. Is what we're going for is accountability. We're going for empathy. We're going for, you know, connection, genuine relationships. That brings to mind performative versus genuine allyship. I've heard that sort of, you know, binary. I would say a white mentor that I really, really respect, who's very much in her journey of, you know, learning to become an anti-racist. And I don't like, actually, George, you know, they say cultural competency. I'm like, ain't no such thing. Can right. we just say, like, cultural humility? Like, you just need to be like, I'm a learner, right? And even towards my own people. Like, I can't approach every Korean female client who's Christian and be like, I know your whole story. Mm-hmm. And I have done that in the past, and it's been detrimental. I've had to do repair work. But this mm-hmm. idea of approaching these spaces, we're using the word space a lot, but, you know, groups of people having conversations, being able to put down performance, which is very, I feel like, Asian, like we're high performers, right? High achievers. It's part of our culture to reduce shame by performing well, thus bringing honor to ourselves and our families. right? Very, I'm thinking of Mulan for some reason. Perform! Perform your allyship, perform your wokeness. But then in that community, what I love is that they're really going for empathy and genuineness and authenticity, which means learning to be really comfortable with the discomfort, which I feel like Asians suck at. Humans suck at that. But particularly in our culture, sitting with our shame exposed, it feels cringy. But that's such an important part of the process for learning to sit with our own vulnerability, and then for others to see, right? Like, this is my shame, you know? And I'm sitting with it, and this is how I feel about it. And to create that space where others can say, I see your shame, and I wanna love you, and I wanna care for you, and I wanna say that I feel the same shame, maybe, right? Or something adjacent to it. Mm. But all that's really hard work. And it's a lot of emotional labor. But that's always what I'm kind of trying to tell myself, because Leah, I do the same thing. Like, the panels and conferences and workshops I do, I'm like scanning. Where am I on the totem pole? And if I feel on the lower half, I'm going to just shut up for fear that I'm going to put my foot in my mouth. But then if I feel like, oh, I'm one of the more woke ones or more educated, I have something to offer here. Or if I just feel really safe, like with erasing shame, you know, our space here, then I'll just be like, hey, this is my hot mess. This is my opinion and experience. It is what it is. Cancel me if you need to. But I feel great to share here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's hard to move out of performance, but it's such a worthwhile process because it's so healing to fully show up as who we are, where we are, and then to be received and accepted for that. But it's scary. It is definitely scary and anxiety provoking. Yeah. I'm still learning how.
Thank you.
Well, as we round up with a closing thought, thank you for the teaser. Our next episode will be about cancel culture, an episode that we previously recorded and wanted to juxtapose based on the timing of what's happening in the country. So tune in for the next episode where we will talk about cancel culture. As we've done quite a bit of processing about awakening and practicing allyship and empathy, this is my confession, is I in my growth as a person engaging with public audience. I work pretty hard at starting strong, but I don't land the plane well, which means I don't know how to wrap things up. So as each of you would weigh in with a closing word, that would be so awesome.
DJ, I think we, in our messages before this recording, George, you suggested wrapping up with things that we could do, which is always a great way to wrap up, right? Of giving direction, suggestions, guidance, hope, resources. So I believe, DJ, you're going to add a link to the Stop Asian Hate and all the sort of happenings that we can be part of. I guess what I want to close with is just kind of a gracious encouragement to our listeners and to each other here and to myself. It's okay, you know, it's okay not to be okay. And it's okay to take things, not even a day at a time, but like an hour or a minute at a time. Like, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's okay. And it's all right to be a hot mess, even when we are leaders with platforms and responsibilities. It's okay to be a mess, you know, because we're definitely not alone. Mm-hmm. We're not the only ones. Everyone is kind of just trying to cope and survive. And everyone's at varying levels of performance right now, just to survive. And it's all right, because I believe it won't always be this way. But sometimes, you know, we can just kind of hunker down together in a bit of a group huddle, recognize that we are where we are, and just take a moment, you know. It's okay to be where you are.
I think I would say your quote-unquote wokeness number does not equate to your worthiness number. Not change that, it does not dictate how enough you are. So A, there is no wokeness number, but B, that doesn't, no matter where you find yourself in that journey, you are enough and you are worthy just because you exist.
Very good. Thank you. Kind words.
Yeah. I think in terms of what you can be doing for yourself, for those who are listening, again, give yourselves the opportunity to slow down and to stop being so busy. Oftentimes, the reason why that buffering circle comes up is because you have way too many web browsers open, you have way too many things processing in the background. So you kind of just need to close some of those windows, let yourself slow down a little bit, and give yourself the opportunity to really ask yourself where you're at, and try not to run away so much. I don't know if the video is going to be posted at all or not, but I often use a finger trap to help teach this. And in this space, oftentimes our initial reaction to running away from uncomfortable or with uncomfortable thoughts and feelings is to run away. And in the finger trap metaphor, you pull your fingers out as an immediate response, but it just makes it tighter. It makes it harder to deal with. And the reality is we have to push in a little bit. We have to lean in a little bit to those uncomfortable spaces and give ourselves the opportunity to free ourselves from that discomfort. So lean in, even though it's hard, give yourselves a chance to really go through the feelings and asking the tough questions. And it'll make you a better empathizer with yourself. It'll make you a better empathizer with other people. And it's really what's going to help the world continue to heal one bit at a time.
Thank you. Thank you, George, Leah, Hannah. And we'll add a link in the show notes to stopasianhate.info with lots more resources to engage on the activism level as well on the personal self-care level. We want to encourage you to give yourself much grace to survive and care and become healthier. We're all enduring the storms of life as COVID vaccines are just being distributed. We still don't know exactly what life's going to look like post-vaccine. And we need to be healthy for the long term before we can move towards thriving and changing the world. So stay engaged, stay healthy, find someone trustworthy that you feel safe with, trust your feeling there, and express your feelings so that you can grow in health. So thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. The video will be posted. And you can watch that on YouTube and Facebook. And of course, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Android, and other podcast platforms. Thanks for tuning in. Come back to the next episode for our conversation on cancel culture. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Erasing Shame Podcast. Check out our website at erasingshame.com. We would love to hear your comments and questions. Please subscribe on any podcast app like Apple, Google, Spotify, or on Facebook and YouTube. And please add a rating, a review, and a share so more people can experience the freedom and healing that comes from erasing shame.